our Open Journal magazine package. Hope you tune in, and thanks for listening to KPFT Houston.
Hi there, I'm Luba Dvorak, singer-songwriter here in Houston, Texas. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
I'm going blind from the brake lights on this L.A. freeway tonight.
Wednesday, and it's time for award-winning So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, where every week we place a spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. And you're going to take these journeys only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I'm the producer and today's host, Hank Rubicek. You know, journey is a word I often use to describe what a listener takes if absorbed by a story. What makes this idea more intriguing for the listener is that a skilled and accomplished teller can return the listener safely to the present at the end of that story. Yet, even with the safe return, the story lingers, able to inspire a loving heart and capture the soul. It's a tall order for anyone with a story to tell unless that story is so essential, so powerful, that it becomes an effortless as a mother lifting a car to save her child. My guest is exactly this kind of storyteller, and because the pictures she paints are so vivid, you'll not only hear, but see her story unfold in front of you. Always a writer, Ellen Titelman Wall began her professional career by joining Grammy-nominated pop songwriter, pianist, and radio host Jim Brickman, writing lyrics to many of his songs. In fact, for some 15 years, she wrote jingles for ad campaigns in Chicago, New York, and Cleveland. She was a contributing writer to Brickman's Soothe campaign, music laced with gentle sounds of nature. As a complement to this crusade to encourage calm, Ellen wrote weekly blogs with advice on bringing calm to a chaotic world. She gives helpful, quirky life lessons on her frequent guest appearances on the syndicated Jim Brickman radio show. Now, curiously, knowing something about a sense of calm would be tested when she became interested in wellness and self-care. It began when she was losing herself while helping her husband Jack recuperate from a myriad of illnesses. She felt that she was wrong to feel the utter physical and emotional exhaustion that happens when committed to managing the health and safety of someone else. And if that someone else is your spouse, the anxiety and depression which come with that exhaustion can lead to indefinable burnout. Still, Ellen discovered burnout was normal. And after seeking support from other family caregivers, she realized she needed a breather. Daily journaling helped with her voyage from grief to joy, and the daily laughter she shares with her children and grandchildren allows her to enjoy the beauty that they create for her. Now, these serve as byproducts of the unexpected nature of life, an unforgettable journey which emerged in her book, Snap Out of It, An Unexpected Caregiver's Way to Self-Care, Stability, and Survival. And this journey, this story, like the kind to which I earlier referred, will linger in your hearts and soul. Ellen, are you there?
I am. Hi, Hank.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well.
As if I hadn't asked you, you know, like 10 minutes ago. I am so glad you're here.
I'm still doing well.
And, you know, this is really exciting. First of all, I want listeners to know Ellen and I are friends, and we grew up in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. We went to high school together and college, and, you know, we said things like, hey, how are you? We did that for about eight years. And it's interesting, and it speaks to the power of story, because when we have stories to tell, we find our friends. Mm-hmm. Ellen, I got to tell you real quickly, tell us one of your life lessons.
Well, everything in my book and my life stems from the fact that I learned that you cannot be stressed 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Our bodies and minds just aren't designed to do that. And it's not okay. It's just not okay.
Right.
So it's important to cultivate calm. But that doesn't mean to avoid every stressful situation and every emotion.
Right.
But then you pull into compassion. And it's okay to feel bad sometimes.
Yeah.
And resilience doesn't mean we're happy all the time. But it means we'll have the energy and the mindset and the support to move on.
Right.
And I think that's the basis of everything that I write about.
Beautiful. I believe that. You know, yeah, I worry about people who's happy all the time. Why is what I ask myself. You know, you're not trick-or-treating. Why are you so happy today? But that's a great point. Your book, let me just read Jim Brickman's quote, because I think it really says it all. Ellen Wall tells a captivating story of love, grit, and resilience in the face of constant medical drama. It made me laugh, cry, and breathe a sigh of relief every time she finds a way to soothe. I couldn't put it down. Well, you know, I couldn't either. And I'm not just saying that because I put a lot of books down, but I couldn't put yours down. It really is filled with, well, not quirky lessons, but I detected an implicit recipe for finding calm in the midst of chaos. One thing for sure is that each story that you offer is really incredible. But before we get into this first story that you're going to share with us called Fasten Your Seatbelts, The Bipolar Express, tell us how you met Jack.
Oh, our love affair was like a summer rom-com. We were camp counselors at a day camp out in Burton, Ohio. It was a JCC day camp
mm-hmm.
with, you know, beautiful grounds and lakes. And the first summer, I didn't pay any attention to him. He paid no attention to me. And then the next summer we were there, our eyes were opened, and we went on a date on the 4th of July, and we're together ever since because he proposed 2 months later. And
wow.
I said, yes.
Yeah. What was it about him that you knew this is the guy?
Well,
I know there's a lot of things, but what's that one thing?
His smile just exuded his warmth and his sincerity and his love of everything around him.
Yeah.
And you could see it in his gorgeous blue eyes, and everybody always talked about his smile.
Yeah. Well, I see a smile in the way that you describe it. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, words are nothing until you do something with it, and you do such beautiful things with yours. You chose a few stories to share with us today. So let's start with Fasten Your Seatbelts, The Bipolar Express.
Okay, fasten your seatbelts. Here it starts. I heard my husband Jack in the kitchen early one morning, but the smell of Maxwell House wasn't wafting through the air. I went downstairs to see what he was up to. The kitchen table was covered with stacks of notebook paper, and I was stunned to see Jack proudly reviewing page after page. Suddenly, he noticed me standing in the doorway, silently taking in this strange scene. He began talking so rapidly he could barely catch his breath or swallow the spit flying out of his mouth. He excitedly described the papers in front of him, a business venture he was concocting. I stood there motionless in disbelief as he told me about opening hot dog carts around downtown Cleveland. You know how the hot dog carts and the vendors on every corner, right? I'm going to buy all those carts and hire hookers to sell hot dogs. And my first thought was, you're kidding, right? But it wasn't so much the hot dog plan that confused me. Well, okay, that was weird. But it was the way he was talking that made my legs go weak. The more frantically he explained his plan, the more irritated he became that I couldn't follow his visions of grandeur. Jack put his papers on the shelf where I couldn't reach them. Don't touch them, he ordered. He became obsessed about quitting his job and making millions. I worried about what was going to happen when he got to work. If he really did quit, we'd be screwed. We had two little kids. But I had to let him go, hoping he'd calm down. Jack's incessant talking and bizarre delusions became a daily occurrence. At first, I was in denial, desperately wanting to believe it would go away. I wondered if Jack was doing drugs. There was no other justification for his excessive energy, especially when he stayed awake all night. Plus, his emotions ran wild. I watched him go through a full range within the course of a few minutes. 1 minute, he'd be the happiest guy in the room, and in the blink of an eye, sadness overwhelmed him and tears flowed. This went out for weeks. I was still in denial. Suddenly, he developed an uncontrollable urge to spend money, quickly depleting our savings account. He reassured me that everything was fine, even when he bought a fancy car. Well, wake up, Ellen. No amount of rationalization would make this normal. I reached out to Jack's Aunt Ruth, who was the fairy godmother of our family. The next day, she came to our house, and my eyes met hers. We weren't buying his explanation that he was so happy he wanted to cry, but we let him talk. I was relieved that I finally had an ally. His aunt charged into action and immediately called her brother to get him help as soon as possible. The next morning, Jack's uncle picked him up for work as usual. In Jack's mind, his uncle was taking him to the bank to invest in the hot dog carts. I had no idea he was going to see a psychiatrist. Before he understood what was happening, Jack was admitted to a psychiatric hospital. He let me know that where he was and that he would be fine. He'd be home for dinner because the doctor didn't know what he was doing. I had never dealt with sickness or hospitals. I was just relieved that he was going to get help. Days passed, and I wasn't allowed to see Jack. I was in the dark about his condition, despite his calls every day saying he was fine. What I didn't know was that his aunt and uncle were getting daily reports from the psychiatrist, who happened to be a family friend. So Aunt Ruth said to me, Jackie says you're spending a lot of time writing jingles. He told the doctor you have a big business now. It's because of you that he's sick. If you're so big, take care of yourself. You don't need me. Well, suddenly I was the enemy. I felt betrayed by her accusations that I made Jack sick. Guilt began to consume me. What if I really did cause this nightmare? I beat myself up trying to figure out what could I have done differently. Finally, our kids and I were permitted to visit. He introduced me to his friends, the other patients in the psychiatric unit, who thought Jack was brilliant, a god. In therapy, Jack told the doctors exactly what he knew they wanted to hear, so they assumed he was making progress. Well, when I visited him, his behavior was still wild and out of control. I felt double-crossed. Didn't he want to get well? It infuriated me to think that he was manipulating the staff. And Aunt Ruth was still pissed off at me. There was no caller ID back then, so I had no idea when her screaming and berating would come flying through the phone line. This woman, who I adored, made it clear I was no longer worthy of her love. What the hell happened? Why would she turn on me so fast? Even though Jack was in the hospital being monitored 24/7, why was I still being blamed for him not getting better? One afternoon, when we were both visiting Jack, she literally backed me into a corner. I could feel my knees buckling as I reached back to balance against the wall. She got right in my face and shouted at me, "Look what you've done to Jackie! He was fine until you started running around." I was completely dumbfounded. "You think you're so big and important," she screamed at me. "Well, you're nothing and you'll get nothing from me." I didn't want anything. I just wanted her to stop yelling. "You neglected him," she shrieked. "You destroyed him." Well, she finally broke me. I wiped away tears with the back of my hand, trying not to let her words sting. But she noticed. "Go ahead, cry now. It's not going to do you any good," she screamed. She was relentless. I was speechless. What if I did make him sick? Was I a horrible person? Is this what brainwashing feels like? Jack's nurses observed that I became the verbal punching bag. He belittled and criticized me during my daily visits. It was wearing me down. She told me to cut my visits short and eventually not to visit every day. After seeing the confrontations between me and his aunt, she gave her the same orders. After weeks of therapy and trying different medications, Jack was finally able to come home for a trial visit. It was a combination of happy and terrified. They told me the key to success was keeping things relatively normal. He played with the kids and showed no signs of frustration. I was a wreck. We went out to dinner with my sister and brother-in-law, and when we drove him back to the hospital after dinner, my brother-in-law told Jack that he seemed just fine and he was ready to come home. No one saw what I saw. He was delusional and had wild ideas. I was fighting a losing battle alone. The doctors were still baffled by Jack's ever-changing behavior. They started talking about shock therapy. All I could picture was Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There were no guarantees it would help, but he'd become, although he'd be a different person. I put my foot down. Absolutely not. Can't you see he's manipulating you? Well, my persistence finally paid off. It took 2 months of medication changes and a lot of therapy, but eventually they got it right. My husband, with his loving demeanor and joyful personality, came back to me. In the mid-80s, no one knew about manic depression. It wasn't Hollywood's trendy bipolar disorder yet. I was just relieved to learn that the condition was a hereditary chemical imbalance in the brain and not caused by me. Eventually, his relatives forgave me when they saw I took care of him. That's how it ended.
Well,
until the next time.
Yeah. They forgave you for not making him
they
sick.
Forgave
you
me,
and
yes.
your jingle business. You know, now if the emotional turbulence of learning,
right?
yeah, I mean, if the emotional turbulence of learning that Jack suffered from bipolar wasn't enough, he also suffered a heart attack and it required bypass surgery. Now, you give this story the tagline "Tilt-A-Whirl," which is absolutely appropriate. Tell us that story.
All right. Early one November morning, I was putting on my sweats and the phone rang. On the other end of the line, I heard a quiver in the voice of the normally calm Faye, secretary of the federal judge who Jack clerked for. Jack might be having a heart attack, she told me. The ambulance picked him up and rushed him to St. Vincent Hospital, which I didn't even know where it was. Total heart racing, cold sweat, panic swept over me. What should I do? Where do I begin? Mom, Dad, and Aunt Ruth were nowhere to be found. Where was everyone? Why hadn't the cell phone been invented yet? I was stuck in the middle of that classic nightmare where you call out for help, but you have no voice, so no one can hear you, except I was wide awake. Somehow I pulled myself together and I called our friend Eddie. He canceled all his meetings and drove me to the hospital. The group anticipating my arrival could only be characterized as the first line of a bad joke. A judge, his secretary, and a priest walked into a bar. But actually, those were the very people who were waiting for me. And waiting for word on Jack's condition was endless agony. Finally, someone in scrubs took Eddie and me to see Jack lying on a gurney. I was horrified to see so many wires. They seemed to be crawling out of his body. He appeared to be suspended in air and tied to the bed at the same time. Diagnosis? Heart attack caused by 100% blockage. For now, he was stable. Apparently, those were the words I wanted to hear, although I'd never heard them before. A new medication, TPA, the miracle clot buster, had been injected into his artery. I pictured Drano being poured down a clogged sink and busting through unidentified gunk. I assumed he'd be fine. Well, then his uncle intervened, the same one from before. He wanted Jack to be transported to the Cleveland Clinic for world-class cardiac care. In the dark of night, like a covert mission, Jack was loaded into an intensive care ambulance and rushed to the Cleveland Clinic. Eddie and I, guided by the red and blue flashing lights, followed behind to the next emergency room. Once Jack was safely inside, we were dismissed like groupies outside the stage door. The next morning, Jack was taken to the cardiac catheterization lab, where he received the new balloon angioplasty. When the procedure was over, I got a call that the blockage in his arteries was open. I was assured his blood flow was good. Well, the worst part was seeing him lying perfectly flat on his back for 8 hours to allow the wound site to close. I went to the hospital room and saw sandbags and vice grips on his groin, holding him in place. Honestly, it looked like a medieval torture rack. I sat by the bed listening to him complain. After 2 days, Jack was sent home, and now I was the caregiver, moving forward blindly. For the next 2 nerve-wracking months, I struggled through a self-taught crash course in cardiac nutrition and medicine. Heart healthy was not yet a catchphrase that rolled off the tongue. Low fat, this and that hadn't even been invented yet. After 2 months of never letting my guard down, Jack's chest pains began once again. He was loaded into an ambulance and returned to the Cleveland Clinic in record time. The angioplasty had collapsed, which set his condition back to its original status of blockage in his artery. Because Cleveland is on Lake Erie, we are besieged by a meteorological phenomenon called lake effect snow. 2 to 3 inches of wet, fluffy white stuff falls per hour, leaving the roads treacherous to plow and even more dangerous to drive. But our kids and I drove through the hazardous snow-covered streets every day to visit him. With Jack's blood pressure and EKG stable, we hoped against hope he'd be home for his birthday the following week, but he wasn't. The artery was still blocked. So 6 days after his 39th birthday, Jack received quite a gift, a triple coronary bypass. Would this be the relief he needed to keep his arteries open, or was it just another ordeal with frustrations and limitations? We have to wait and see. The night before surgery, the kids and I decided to go rogue. On our way down to the hospital, we stopped at Pizza Hut to grab a few slices of pepperoni pizza for Jack, because we knew it was going to be contraband after that. When we told the clerk our crazy story, he gave us an entire 16-inch pizza for free. That was a little harder to sneak into the cardiac unit. The nurses laughed when the unmistakable aroma floated in with us. Apparently, we weren't the only ones bringing in contraband the night before heart surgery. We were sitting with Jack as he ate the pizza when a nurse pushed an AV cart into the hospital room. You know, the kind teachers used to show films on and the kids would zone out. The nurse hooked up the wires to the TV and told us we needed to watch how the bypass surgery was performed and what to expect afterwards. Jack said, "I'm not watching that," and bolted out of bed and took off for the hall with the kids. I was stuck in the room with the nurse when she started the video player. Seeing the IV tubes filled with anesthesia wasn't so bad, but watching the cardiac surgeon cut an 8-inch incision in the middle of the chest was gag-worthy. I told the nurse I'd seen enough. The genius that decided an informed family was a relaxed family was sadly mistaken. Now I was a nervous wreck. The next morning, surrounded by my mom, my aunt, and my friend Beth, I watched the clock for hours while Jack's chest was opened and his heart was repaired. Finally, a nurse appeared. "Family for Wall!" Her words unexpectedly derailed my train of thought. Jack was out of surgery. The surgeon arrived and took me aside to talk. He showed me a diagram of what had been done and the arteries that were rerouted. The details blurred in my head. "Just tell me it was successful and he'll be okay." Jack spent the next week recuperating in the CICU, and I appreciated the round-the-clock attention he was given. The staff told me over and over again, "Go relax, we've got him covered." They constantly reminded me, "If you don't take care of yourself, you'll be no good to him." At last, Jack was strong enough to be transferred out of intensive care to the step-down floor. He was able to hold the IV pole and walk up and down the hall. The color returned to his face. The day of Jack's discharge, the cardiologist stopped by the room to review the surgical highlights and let Jack know that he'd spend the next 6 weeks recuperating at home. The doctor looked at him with a very solemn expression and said, "Do you have any questions for me?" Jack immediately asked, "When can I play softball?" I wanted to strangle him. Apparently, though, it was good incentive because a few months later, he returned to the softball field and continued playing for many years until the next thing happened.
Wow. I want listeners to know there is 27 chapters to this wonderful book. And, well, you know, these 27 chapters, 27 image-driven stories of the most indescribable human trajectories you've ever heard. You really have. It really tests its strength and spirit. It's just wonderful. What a story. And by the way, everybody out there, there's no lake effects. It's a myth. There's no lake effects. Oh, lake effects. Well, that explains it. No, it doesn't. It's like your mother saying, "You're watching TV. You're too close to the TV. Your eyes will be crossed." It takes the same thing. Okay, so the escalation is continuing. It's almost like a hierarchy of tragedy. Now lung cancer.
Yeah.
You call this story merry-go-round.
Yeah. So Jack developed a cough that wouldn't go away, and he was diagnosed with lung cancer. Our doctor said confidently, "It looks treatable, but Jack will need surgery." We were overwhelmed with anxiety in anticipation of our first appointment with the surgeon. He tried to calm our fears. As he popped the X-ray of Jack's lung onto the viewer, he pointed out that the tumor appeared to be encapsulated, meaning it was self-contained. "Relax, that's a good thing," he assured us. "The likelihood that it has spread is slim." The right upper lobe of Jack's lung would be removed. To our amazement, he told us, "There's a good chance Jack won't need chemo or radiation." And with every pre-op test, he came back with good news that the malignancy hadn't spread. The day of surgery, we arrived at the hospital at the crack of dawn. It felt so much different from Jack's heart procedures. With that, we knew what to expect. This was cancer. This was unknown. The attendants appeared to take Jack into the operating room. And as I did with every surgery, I leaned over, kissed him, and said, "Don't give the doctors any trouble." As I wheeled him down the long hall, I took a deep breath and said a silent prayer. For almost 4 hours, After almost 4 hours, a surgical nurse appeared to tell us the surgery was over and Jack had done well. We breathed a sigh of relief, and then the surgeon came out with more good news. The tumor was encapsulated, and the malignancy did not spread. The lymph nodes are clear, no chemo, no radiation. Jack was cancer-free, and we could go see him in recovery for a few minutes. Seriously, that never happened before. When we walked in, Jack was sitting up in bed, big smile, talking to the nurse, slightly giddy from the anesthesia. He appeared to be doing really well. We spent a few minutes with him and left so he could rest. As we walked away, he was still happy and jabbering away. I went home to relax, and I closed my eyes to take a nap, and the phone rang. A voice was telling me Jack had become unresponsive and grew violent. I needed to come back right away. "This can't be happening," I cried out loud. "The doctor told me he was fine." I jumped in the car and raced back to the hospital. The intensive care unit looked like a control room on the Starship Enterprise. It was filled with machines wheezing and beeping as they kept Jack alive. He looked very small, wrapped in a mass of tubes and wires. My heart sank when I noticed that his arms and legs were restrained. I gasped, "Why is he tied to the bed?" "He pulled the drain out of his lung," the nurse explained. "I can't believe this." I tried not to yell. "He was sitting up and talking in recovery. How could this happen?" I ventured a guess. "Did he get his bipolar meds?" The nurse checked his chart. "It looks like something was withheld." "Well, he needs them," I said. I walked over to the bed where Jack was moaning and pulling on the restraints. I spoke quietly. "Jack, you need to rest. The doctor said you're going to be fine." His eyes opened a crack, and I swear he murmured, "Help me." I anxiously met the nurse's eyes. "Well, what does the surgeon say?" "Oh, he only does the surgery. He doesn't manage the recovery. We have a team for that." "Well, then, can I talk to the head of the team?" "I'll have him call you." I was sent home to wait for the call. "What just happened?" my brain screamed. Eventually, the call came. "We're trying to understand the change in your husband's condition. He's worse than we expected." "But the surgeon said everything had gone well. Jack was talking a few hours ago. I asked again about his meds." "I have a psychiatrist looking into that," he said. "He'll get back to you." I didn't wait for the call. I got in the car and drove back to the hospital. While I was in the unit looking for more answers, an incompetent psychiatrist, who I comically misidentified as Dr. Schnitzker, appeared. I hadn't yet guessed the depth of his incompetence. He said matter-of-factly, get this, "It looks like the malignancy spread to Jack's brain. You need to make arrangements. He may be a vegetable." No, I wasn't having any of this. He had full body scans. It couldn't have spread. I refused to accept it. The next morning, when I called for an update on Jack's condition, I was told he may have had a stroke. I quickly called my friend Beth, who worked with stroke patients. We ran to see him. To me, Jack looked the same as he did the day before, still tubed and tied. We tried talking to him. He responded to us, but barely. Beth touched his limbs, and his reactions were slow but present. She told me, "There's no way he had a stroke. He's reacting like a person on a lot of drugs." Two long, frightening days and sleepless nights later, I got a call from the infamous Dr. Schnitzker. Oh, no, not him again. "Does Jack have a gastroenterologist?" "No," but I thought quickly. "Would Dr. Frankel be okay?" I asked, the only one I knew. "Yes, we'll call him." I ran to the hospital and found Mike Frankel looking at Jack's chart. It took him only a minute to determine the problem. The anesthesia wasn't processing through Jack's liver, and the backup was causing this strange behavior. Thank goodness, Dr. Frankel prescribed something, and within 45 minutes, Jack miraculously returned from the outer limits as his liver cleared out the poison. I saw my sweet husband emerge from the stupor that had trapped him. The staff was amazed to see the real Jack come back to life again.
Wow. He actually said he could be a vegetable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's like a bad soap opera.
You don't forget something like that.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Yeah.
I know.
Some of these stories, I mean, you know, I just wanted to go back for a moment that you, when he was, when Jack was imagining this wonderful success story with the hot dog stands, you know, the difference between the dream and the delusion. What was the moment? Can you kind of give us a 30-second capsulization of when did you know that this wasn't a dream, it was a delusion? Just curious.
Oh, he kept talking about making millions. Mm-hmm. And that's something classic with bipolar disorder, that delusions of grandeur.
Sure.
Now, he had talked years ago about opening stands in Vegas, but it was a totally different thing.
Right.
This, it was just, he thought he could do no wrong. He thought that this, he was like the messiah of the hookers.
Yeah. You know, I know you've told these stories a lot of times, Ellen, but right now, you know, right now you're telling them again to a listenership that you haven't met, except for some of our classmates who's tuning in.
Hi, guys.
And, yeah, hi, everybody. But how do you feel so far telling these three stories? How do you feel about telling these when they unfold
in your
mind?
If I told you my heart was racing because I'm reliving it, I'm not lying. It's it catches my emotions again.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why, and I want everybody to know, one of the reasons why Ellen's book is so remarkable, in my opinion, is that not only can you not put it down, but you want to reread it because it's like your favorite movie. Every time you see the movie, you see something different in it, right? And that's what I think about your book. I haven't read the entire book a second time, but I've read much of it a second time, and that's how I feel. I see different things. So when you tell me, when you tell us that your heart is racing and you relive it, that's what storytellers do. You know, they take people on journeys, and then they return them safely to the present. I made reference to that at the beginning of this show, and that's exactly what you're doing. Wow. You are listening.
I'm glad you're getting there.
Just remarkable. You are listening to my guest storyteller, Ellen Titelman Wall, deliver some delicate narratives from her book, Snap Out of It, An Unexpected Caregiver's Way to Self-Care, Stability, and Survival on So What's Your Story on KPFT, Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, HD1 here in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. This is Hank Rubicek, and we sure do appreciate you hanging around with us. Want to introduce you quickly to Basil Simon. Basil, who is a fabulous energy engineer, he takes us idiot programmers and make us sound really good. Basil, in a minute or so, because I know you're looking, you're a smart guy, you're attentive. What do you think about these stories?
I definitely think they're interesting just to see, like, the healthcare, I guess, how do you say, the healthcare inattentiveness in a way?
Right.
Because it seems like a lot of the stories were about somebody not understanding the full range of what somebody can go through, both as the person going through the health issue and the loving ones around them, especially, like, the wife, in this case, Miss Ellen.
Yeah.
And I think, Miss Ellen, you've done a wonderful job of encapsulating those stories of you being the second half of what goes on with somebody that has, like, an illness, whether it's undiagnosed because of the times or because there are certain prejudices that people have about illness and all that stuff. Yeah. So, and really what took me back was when you mentioned from a healthcare worker, they said, oh, yeah, they might be a vegetable, like your husband, the person that you love all this time could be a vegetable. And that's just using that terminology, I think, would be very heartbreaking. And your resilience to say, nah, that's not it, because it sounds a lot like my mom. She sort of had the similar experience with my grandfather, who had sort of heart issues and heart attacks and things of that nature. And every time he had a heart attack, because he smoked a lot, too. So there are some other complications as well. But just hearing all that sort of brought me into that space of, like, my grandfather going through this similar type of health crises and people being like, oh, you should do this, or you should do that, or, you know, it is sort of too late at this point. And my mom saying, that's not it.
Yeah, those are some great insights. Yeah. Those are some great insights. You know, and storytelling itself is a healing process. So I think that as we listen to the stories, and I think that's what Basil is really saying, that it reminds you of things. You know, when we talk about a story that resonates, excuse me, it's not necessarily a story that we have to experience. It's not the exact same episode. It's something that makes our lives memorable because we're all born with a blank page. And I think that these stories resonate, whether we can relate to them exactly or not. And I think that's what Basil's talking about.
Yeah, they definitely resonate, was the long story short of that.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about a little bit of maintenance. The Houston Storytellers Guild sponsors this show. So let me give them a quick shout out because they are the most supportive group you're going to find anywhere. And they're going to help you develop your skills as a storyteller. They meet virtually on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next swap is next Tuesday on the 23rd. So please visit their website at HoustonStorytellers.org for the Zoom link and links to all of their swaps and information about upcoming events. You know, our friends at the Moth at the New Warehouse Live in Midtown, the second Tuesday of the month, are doing their great thing. It's also a great date night. Besides, it's like a bar. It's a bar. So if you don't like your date, get a drink, listen to the stories, and you won't have to pay any attention to the person you're with. So it's a great date night. That was a terrible thing to say. But true.
Sounds fun.
All right? But it's true, right? Absolutely. A little bit about, you know, I know that we're always talking about fun drives at this station, and although we're not currently in one, I want to remind you that we are listener-sponsored, and only your generosity supports us, and it's been going on for the last 50 years, and this award-winning show for the last 15, So What's Your Story is an icon in community radio, real people. Real stories and real lives. Nothing filtered, nothing fake, just the spotlight on you. And that's what you're paying for when you give us a call at 713-526-5738, Jam KPFT, or go to kpft.org with your kind donations. Thank you so, so much. You know, Ellen, real quick, I hadn't planned on talking about this, but in your chapter on Splash Mountain, you talk about, you know, you talk about all of the wonderful things that you've done and that you were in the Alumni Hall of Fame. So am I, as I told you. I have no idea who nominated me, though. It might have been my mother, for all I know, but I don't know.
My sister nominated me, but
it's great. I love it. I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a fun day.
Yeah. I was given the honor, you know, for communication as a communication professor, and I did various things. And I was very proud of that, and I gave my acceptance speech, and at the time I had nodules on my larynx. So here I am, a communication professor, saying, thank you so much. You know, it was a Don Corleone imitation. So, yeah. Listen, the need to listen to your stories and to read this book can't be overstated. There are a lot more caregivers or well-spouse than we think. According to ARP, you were saying, how many caregivers are there, roughly?
14 million family caregivers.
Unbelievable.
So that's like not hired. That's, yeah. I don't trust anyone to take care of my husband. I'm
right.
Doing it.
I gotcha. Let's
there's
also
support systems all over the place.
That's amazing. I mean, that number is just, it's unfathomable. Let's talk about the snap and the snap out of it. Your mother told you and your sisters to step out of it when acting goofier than usual in your teenage years. And you have isolated segments peppered throughout this book called Snap. Read us a sample and explain the reason, please.
Okay. So, as I said before, if you just keep stressing and stressing and stressing, you're not going to have any power to get yourself well and helpful. So Jack was in the hospital, of course, at one time, and I was pacing around, and a handsome young nurse suggested I go up to the rooftop. And I'm like, to jump? What? He said, take a few minutes for yourself. It's beautiful up there. You can see Lake Erie and the whole Cleveland skyline. So I got in the elevator, pressed penthouse, and rode up to the penthouse floor. The doors opened, revealing a sprawling rooftop terrace with ceiling-to-floor windows and a spectacular view of the city. I made my way through the indoor plaza and headed straight to the outdoor walkway. A breath of fresh air greeted me. I inhaled as a slight, gentle breeze blew in off Lake Erie. The water sparkled like a million diamonds in the sunlight. The sky was clear, and I could see the blue angels zooming overhead practicing for Labor Day. Being in the middle of the metropolitan area, this was as close as I was going to get to be to nature. If you can get out in a garden or a park, there's a lot to be said for relaxing among the flora and fauna. Within minutes, it can revitalize and energize. It improves well-being, lowers blood pressure, and eases muscle tension. You'll feel better emotionally because being outdoors can reduce stress hormones. And even if it's impossible to be out in a park or a garden, simply hearing sounds or viewing scenes of waterfalls and ocean waves, trees rustling in the wind and flowers blooming really helps calm anger and fear, and it can foster a much more pleasant mood. And you can go on YouTube and find nature videos and go on Alexa. I can't say Alexa too loud. She'll answer me. But, you know, she plays ocean waves for me all the time. And it's just really relaxing. And if you can't be outside, there's your answer. Wow. And it helps. It really, truly does.
Wow, that is wonderful. What a great addition. Okay, so, you know, things seem to be settling down, but then they spiral again out of control, right?
Oh,
with a heart attack again.
Yeah,
coupled
another
with induced coma. And
this is
perfectly labeled roller coaster.
Tell us
about that saga.
Okay. Our kids, Ricky and Lindsay, like to tease me about my sixth sense. I always seem to know when one of them is in trouble, from a parking lot brawl after a high school basketball game to a sorority house fire. Nobody doubts my powers. So one morning I got in the car to go to work, turned the key in the ignition, and was struck by a gut feeling that something wasn't right. I ran upstairs to check on Jack. His face was gray and his skin was clammy. I grabbed the phone and called 911. The few minutes it took to hear the sirens coming down campus road felt like an eternity. The EMS team raced in, Jack was loaded in the ambulance, and rushed back to the Cleveland Clinic. I knew the drill, wait 25 minutes and go down the drive down to the emergency room. I figured by that time, when I got there, he'd be sitting up in bed, examined, and all smiles. That's how it usually was. But when I arrived, I checked in at the desk, as I had done many times over the past 15 years. I was told that Jack arrived but wasn't in the ER. I was directed to take a seat. The minutes dragged, but timing was everything. His brilliant cardiologist, and I mean brilliant, Dr. Amar Krishnaswamy, just happened to be in the cath lab that morning. He ordered Jack to be taken there immediately, but my gut told me this still wasn't good. To my relief, Ricky showed up, and we walked through a maze of hallways to the Miller Pavilion, where the cardiac procedures take place. I felt like my head was underwater. I was drowning in a sea of uncertainty. What was still causing this feeling? We assumed the cardiologist would put in a stent to open a blockage, and Jack would be on his way to recovery. Well, unbeknownst to us, at that moment, his doctor was busy saving Jack's life when his heart stopped beating twice. He delivered electrical shocks and eventually brought him back to a normal rhythm. Now, normally, Jack would have stayed in recovery for a short time and then moved to a room on the step-down floor. He'd relax, eat dinner, and come home the next day. This was anything but normal. We didn't comprehend that the situation was more serious, even when we were directed to the third floor critical care unit. It started to register when we weren't permitted to see him. The receptionist suggested we find a seat in the packed waiting room. There were two empty chairs in what looked like a tent city. Every face wore the same weary expression. These people were camped out with sleeping bags, pillows, and coolers of food and drink. My God, how long had they been there? My thoughts were interrupted by the chime of my phone. Our rabbi was on his way. Well, no matter how sick a patient is, the clergy can visit. So the rabbi was escorted to Jack's room. Now, in a typical visit, he'd say a prayer for recovery and guidance for the doctors. I only wish this was a typical visit. He came back out to sit with us. He quietly explained that the doctor ordered Jack to be sedated to give his heart muscle time to heal. It sounded very ominous, but he convinced us we should go home. The following day, I was permitted to enter the critical care unit. I held my breath as I walked gingerly through the security doors. I tried to keep my head down. My eyes avoided the sights of patients struggling to stay alive. It smelled of disinfectant and dread. When I entered Jack's room, my mouth dropped in shock at what I saw. I barely recognized my husband lying in the bed. An oxygen mask was taped to his face, and a tube was in his mouth. He was wrapped from head to toe in a highway of wires and tubes. A machine was pumping oxygen into his lungs, breathing for him, helping his heart to beat. My eyes were transfixed on every green and blue line as it blipped across the monitor like a low-lying mountain range. I spotted a chair and pulled it a little closer to the bed, having no idea this would be my landing site for the next 10 days. I sat at Jack's bedside for hours at a time. Sometimes I chatted away, telling him about everything going on in the outside world. I hoped his eyes would flicker or he'd squeeze my hand. But it wasn't like a climactic scene in the movies. Absolutely nothing happened. The room was quiet, but the voice in my head screamed, "Why won't you wake up?" Every day became a carbon copy of the one before. The hours crawled by. I ached with heaviness from the weight of worrying. It might hurt my brain to even think about life if and when Jack woke up. Time continued to stand still. The staff insisted nothing was wrong. Jack's so-called coma was medically induced. They assured me, "We're weaning him off the sedatives. Don't worry, he'll wake up." Well, no matter what they told me, I saw no change. When his doctor returned from the medical conference, he was outraged to find that Jack was still unconscious. He was only supposed to have been sedated for 2 or 3 days. He ordered that the drugs be stopped immediately. I was rushed out of the room so they could get to work. The ventilator was removed, miles of tubes and wires disappeared, and within the hour, the veil of fear was lifted. When I returned to the room, Jack was sitting up in bed, looking more like himself, big smile, and joking as if nothing had happened. The next day, he was transferred to the step-down unit, where I had expected to see him 10 days ago.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah. You know, there are so many lessons in all of these stories. I mean, I know that we don't, that we're not going to talk about the story, but I mean, I just want everyone to know that, you know, there's a saga of normal pressure hydrocephalus, the buildup of fluid on his brain. I mean, it just goes on and on.
It goes on and on.
When you
and I
think
tell you
of
something,
yeah.
Wait, let me. What Basil was saying before about the doctors and looking at the patients.
Yeah.
He went to so many different doctors, and nobody was figuring out what it was. One would look at his walking, and one would look at his incontinence.
Right.
Nobody looked at
right.
the total picture. And then he met a neurologist who said to me, the key to solving any medical problem is you have to look at the total patient.
Right.
You have to talk to people who know them, but you can't look at one symptom. And that's something with hydrocephalus that was really, really important.
Yeah. When you think of Jack, I bet you think of his smile, right?
Oh, yes, right,
yeah.
Big time.
I
have a picture of him on the sink with the biggest smile, and I talk to it all the time.
Send it to me. I'll put it on the website, if you don't mind. I'll be happy to
do that.
I'll be happy to put his photograph on the website
if
you send it to me.
Okay.
But, you know, I just want you to know that he sees it. He knows it. He knows you're doing that, right? You believe that, don't you?
Oh, my gosh, that's a whole other story.
I mean, you have to believe that.
We'll tell that story another day.
Okay, and we will. You know, there are so many lessons, just as there are in any story. But, you know, regardless if we're spousal caregivers or never will be, what is the one message, Ellen, the one message that you want us to take away?
Don't give up.
Don't give up.
And don't give up and take care of yourself. Self-compassion. You do you.
Yeah.
You do you. You know, you can do all the caregiving in the world, but if you're not taking care of yourself, it's just going to wear you down. You really, really, really have to take care of yourself and find ways that will make you resilient. Like with me, I cooked, I sang, I danced, I listened to music, I walk outside. you just have to find, even if it's for a couple minutes,
right.
You have to give yourself a reprieve.
Right.
Or you won't be able to carry on.
Now, tell us a jingle that you wrote.
Ah!
That's it?
Ah?
What does that sell? Yeah.
If you're in Cleveland, the most famous was Northfield Park. Every 19 minutes, the place goes crazy.
Right.
And everybody in Cleveland knows that one.
Right.
We did a few McDonald's.
Yeah, right.
You know, we did.
Right. Yeah.
Lots of them, but that was the most famous, and
right.
that's the one everybody always identifies with.
Right. Well, boomers love jingles, you know.
Yeah,
Aqua,
they're like
Aqua Velva Man, right?
Now.
You know,
Pearl
Cream, Little Dabble, do you? Now, youngins right now are listening, and they're thinking, how old are these people, for God's sakes? Well, you know, we're so old that when we were in school, they didn't have history. How's that, everybody, right? Basil, you like that one? Okay, good.
That was a good one,
I'm glad. Good.
That was current events.
Never give up, though. Okay. I love that. You know, there's an old Yiddish saying which goes, God gave us burdens and also gave us a shoulder. And I think that you are that shoulder for so many of us to lean on, Ellen. I really do.
Oh,
I do. I think that's so true. I think that's absolutely true. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. We're not done yet, but thank you so much for revealing all of this strength and these astonishing stories and compassion.
For me.
Just wonderful. I mean, you really do prove the story stretch the boundaries of the human heart. But let me ask you a couple of things. You know, first of all, who was a storyteller in your home growing up? Did you have one?
My dad.
Yeah?
My dad.
What kind of stories did he tell you?
The war. Although he didn't talk about the war, like the political end of the war.
Right.
He talked about the guys and what they were doing in their downtime. I have boxes and boxes of letters that he wrote home. And it was all about, oh, we went into town and we were drinking champagne, or yeah, it was Christmas and I was leading all the Christmas carols because, you know, nobody else knew all the words. And that, he was a character. But yeah, my dad loved to tell
him. Yeah, you better tell everybody what war we're talking about.
World War II.
Thank you.
World War II.
Thank you.
He landed on the beach on D-Day. He's one of those.
Yeah. Well, you know, Basil is laughing. Yeah, well, we have to know what war are we talking about, right?
It wasn't Nam.
Yeah, you know, right? You know, I got to say, well, yeah, and don't get me started on what people know. I always tell the story about how I used to ask my students, when was the Civil War fought? And their answer was, a long time ago. That was their answer. So, yeah, so it's an important question. Absolutely. Now, you are into journaling, and I journaled for... Well, I still do, but I've journaled for 45 years, and we've done shows about journaling, actually. We've talked about what it means to sort of write your thoughts, come out the other side, and to understand that every agenda that's on your mind has to be articulated somehow, and the journal is your friend. How has the journal helped you?
Well, I wrote the book from all my journaling. I would write like letters to people telling them what was going on, and I saved every letter, and some I didn't, you know, send off, but that was how I wrote the book, because it had all my feelings and it had like every detail of what was going on, because people read the book and they're like, how do you remember that? I said, I wrote it all down.
Yeah.
Everything.
Sure.
Everything's in a journal.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in this book entitled Mightier Than the Sword many, many years ago. It was written by Kate Adams. She's still around. She ran the journal for the Center for Journal Therapy in Boulder, Colorado. And not to get into real detail, but I'm in the book, and I'm in the chapter about fatherhood, and it was a real honor. And they asked me and the three other men who were in this book to come out to the book signing. It's called Mightier Than the Sword. Come out to the book signing at Borders Bookstore, old Borders Bookstore in Boulder, Colorado. And I have to tell you, I was there, and I was in the stacks. I didn't want anybody to know that I was there. It was a book signing, and there was a gentleman about my age who read some of my entries about my feelings about my son and about things that I was going through and things that frightened me. And I have to tell you, I was in the stacks. I don't think I ever cried that much. And I went up to him. I went up to him afterwards, and I embraced him, and I said, thank you for this incredible gift. And he was embarrassed, and he said, I didn't know you were there. I wish you would have told me. I would have introduced you. I said, I don't want you to introduce me. What you just gave me was an unbelievable gift. I didn't want you to be distracted. I didn't want you to think I was here, to know that I was here. But somehow, I don't know how he captured. You know, journals give us an opportunity to capture things that I think no other form of writing does. It's more than just creative writing. It's something that, you know, I always believe the stories really come from three places. And actually, your book is a great example of this. You know, stories come from gut, from your gut, they come from your heart, or they come from your head. You know, when they come from your gut, you're talking about rage and anger. And those have to be talked about, don't they? They have to be talked about. And sometimes you've got
stories.
Yeah,
once you put it on the page, you can identify it.
Right. And sometimes your stories come from heart. Tenderness and romance, compassion, things that you give, your level of generosity. And sometimes, You know, sometimes your just stories come from your head, the cerebral things, decision-making, problems that you have to solve. And I think that your book, your stories, I think tonight demonstrated a culmination in all of that. I mean, this is a set of stories, Ellen, that's fueled from heart. Nothing more and nothing less. It's fueled from heart. But, you know, the kind of emotions that you felt, the rage, the anger, had to be debilitating at times.
Yeah.
And,
oh, for sure.
as you said very eloquently a few minutes ago, the message that you want to give us all, whether we are caregivers or not, is to not give up, to be kind to yourself. And I think that comes out so much in this set of stories. Again, this book has got to be read. It is Snap Out of It, An Unexpected Caregiver's Way to Self-Care, Stability, and Survival. Archway Press.
It's available on Amazon.
Amazon. Everything's on Amazon. Everything is on Amazon. Are you kidding?
It's on
get
Amazon.
This book. Get some socks. Get some shampoo. Get it to your place quickly, because this is pretty remarkable. Just great. Thank you, Basil Simon, for your skill and patience, because God knows you need it with people like us. Don't anybody even think about moving, because Michael Woodson and Michael Carson are up next with Living Art, another KPFT exclusive. Make Houston's community station KPFT 90.1 a part of every day. And be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving great stories like the ones you heard tonight by Ellen Titleman Wall, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Thanks, Ellen, so, so much.
Thank you.
Peace, everyone.
Hi, this is Buddy Monlock. I'm always happy to be back in Houston and here in KPFT in the new studio. It's great to be here. I don't know how many times I've been on live here. It's really fun to come in and talk with the DJs and play some songs live. So I really enjoy that. So yeah, please keep listening to KPFT. It's important, and they're the ones who are playing the kind of music that you love and that I love and that me and my friends make. They're kind of holding the torch for us all here. So keep listening to KPFT and maybe do your part when it comes time for the pledge drive.
Tom has been a teacher for over 40 years. One day, I think one of the students had asked the question and he didn't remember the answer. And I also noticed that he was letting his class out earlier than they were supposed to let out. I was really starting to worry.
Levi and I talked about how it would change our lives, but he was there beside me.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Few institutions stand as an icon for the Houston community as Houston's community station, KPFT. When you support our station, you support a group of indescribably dedicated programmers who are fueled by peace. You're on 90.1. Listener rich, commercial free,